Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast of the non-2-hour variety. Along with Jim Callis, I am John Manuel. Jim, I hope you got some caffeine in you. I know you're not a coffee drinker, but a late night last night with the draft signing deadline. I think we'd all appreciate it if the draft signing deadline, Jim, were moved to like 4 o'clock in the afternoon like they do with the trade deadline. That would make a lot of people happy. But welcome back into the podcast, and great work last night, and It was the fifth year of the draft signing deadline, Jim, and I think my favorite part of how the deadline has changed over those 5 years was you were looking back through old draft blogs of 2007, the first year of the deadline and the first year of our draft blog, and I found the post that said that, and then there were eight, and at 11 a.m., so 13 hours before the deadline that morning in 2007, you said, "Well, now that Porcello and Bumgarner are signed, we've got 13 hours till the deadline, and there are 8 unsigned first-round picks." And last night, an hour before the deadline, as you basically predicted, you said the whole summer, we're going to get to 11 o'clock and have 20 unsigned first-round picks. That's where we got with, what, 22 unsigned first-round picks with an hour left. And
23.
Yet,
I think it was
signed.
I think it was 23 because 22 – I'm quibbling, but I actually think it was 23 unless I'm miscounting here on my spreadsheet. So,
well, either way, we had 23 unsigned first-round picks with an hour to go, and yet we had one first-round pick who did not sign. I think we both you expected there would be no unsigned first-round picks. I thought there'd be one or two. I think I was thinking two because the last 3 years we'd had 8 unsigned first-rounders. So we were both off. We had one unsigned first-round pick and Tyler Beede. Our own Aaron Fitt has already spoken to Tyler Beede, the Massachusetts prep right-hander who is going to Vanderbilt. Beede told him he turned down, I think it was $2.4 million and stuck to his number, which was 3.5. So let's start there with our one unsigned first-round pick, Jim. I guess if there was going to be an unsigned first-rounder, a guy going to Vanderbilt, that one made some sense. He was one of the handful of logical guys who wouldn't sign. But what do you think about him not signing in the Blue Jays' overall approach? I don't think they got to $17 to $20 million, but they spent a lot of money last night.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think all the ingredients were there. And I think we talked about this, the possibility there would be an unsigned guy perhaps, but it was hard to necessarily pinpoint who it would be. But the ingredients were there. You know, he was committed to Vanderbilt. There was talk that there were teams behind the Blue Jays who were promising him a bunch of money had he fallen to hit them in the draft, which he didn't. That complicates matters. There were rumors he had a pre-draft deal with Toronto, and I've had people tell me they think it's true. I've had people tell me they think it's untrue. I've had people tell me they think there was a deal, and MLB was coming down on him about it, and so it was pulled off the table. And then you have the way that the MLB was just putting the slow on letting teams negotiate with players, not authorizing them to make overslot offers till the last second. And, you know, going into, I think Tyler Beede also told Aaron Fitt his asking price was 3.5. And going in, you know, I think, you know, an hour or two before the deadline, the Jays were at about $1.5 million and the Beedes were at 3.5. And that's an awful lot of gap to make up, you know, in a short period of time, and it doesn't happen. And I think we said on the pre-deadline podcast, weren't necessarily sure who it might be, but when you have these negotiations basically being put on hold until the last minute, the potential is that you just run out of time to work something out.
And that potential was realized with the Jays and Tyler Beede. I still think the Jays did pretty well for themselves. Daniel Norris gets done for $2 million, much to the chagrin of the Clemson Tigers, these kind of things. But I still think Toronto's draft went fairly well. Let's hit some of the bigger bonuses, Jim, and the teams that paid out those bigger bonuses. I have to say, for me, the biggest shock of the night was Josh Bell, the Pirates' second-round pick, signing with the Pirates for $5 million. It's the largest signing bonus ever for a player after the first round or the supplemental first round. It blew away the old record by $2.25 million, a record that had been there for 10 years, 10 drafts. Was Josh Bell signing for $5 million the biggest shock for you, Jim? That one blew me away.
Yeah, you know, I'm supposed to be this supposed draft expert, and I wrote my Setting the Scene for Deadline Day story for Monday morning, two guys who aren't – the two highest profile guys who aren't expected to sign, Josh Bell, Matt Perk.
I wasn't going to bring that up.
And, you know, my parlay – I mean, and you kept hearing whispers all summer, Josh Bell might sign. You know, and there started little whispers recently, Matt Perk might sign. And, you know, I'm working – basically, I guess the best way to put it without getting – two sides to every negotiation. I'm talking to individuals on both sides of negotiations and not really getting the sense that they're going to sign. And anyway, I think those were the two shockers. I mean, I don't know if this was an orchestrated plan by the Boris Corporation, if there was a change of heart that $5 million is too much to turn down. But all spring, you know, I do our Texas draft coverage. I was told Josh Bell won't sign for $10 million, won't sign for $15 million, won't sign for $20 million. You know, I was told teams offered him, you know, alluded, hey, $7.5 million, we'll draft you if you'll agree to $7.5 million. All this talk, you know, sent the letter to the Major League Scouting Bureau, which in and of itself doesn't mean that you're not going to – you don't want to go pro. You know, other guys have done that before. But, no, I didn't think he was going to sign. And if you told me he was going to sign, I would have thought $5 million, that would have been the under. I always say never bet the under with Scott Boras. I would have bet the under on that one. But you, I'll take my hat off. And I don't know if this was orchestrated or it's just the way it turned out. I love Josh Bell as a prospect. I think he was the best all-around high school bat in the draft. If you want to quibble about the health or the size of Anthony Rendon, I wouldn't agree with you, but I think you could argue that Josh Bell might have the highest all-around offensive ceiling in the draft if you just wanted to go crazy on him. All that said, if there were no signability questions about Josh Bell, you know, he probably goes somewhere between 8 and 15 in the draft, and you know, we're talking about a bonus – you know, in the Francisco Lindor, Javier Baez range, you know, 2.5, you know, between 2.5 and 3, he wouldn't have gotten 5 purely on talent. And again, I don't know if this was he really did want to go to school and changed his mind, or this was a brilliantly calculated plan. But Josh Bell got $5 million, and his market value was probably closer to 2.5. And so that's, however that came about, pretty amazing. But that was some nice work done by somebody.
I agree. I think that's right. You summed it up very well to compare him. Like, you know, who would I rather have, Baez or Bell? That's tough. I mean, Lindor being a shortstop kind of puts Lindor at the front of that group for me. You know, Baez sounds like he has similar offensive upside to Bell with a few more question marks off the field maybe, or just in the makeup, the nebulous makeup. Not a great teammate. That's been thrown at Baez. But I'm of the belief that you can tone a guy down. You can tone a guy with too much fire down. Those kind of guys can mature. So I would take my chances with a Baez, and Baez can play the infield. So I might have taken Javier Baez over him. But like you said, those are the two high school bats ahead of him, and he got $2 million and change more money than they did. So that's pretty nice work, like you said.
I just want to say, too, also give credit for nice work, John. Pirates, excellent pick. Nobody thought he was signable. Pirates, you know, they're headed to, you know, another losing season, you know, after contending, you know, for a while. And they stole a guy who should have been a top 15 pick in this draft with the 61st pick of the draft. I also like the fact, I mean, I know for me, and we've talked about this, going into the second day of the draft after the sandwich round, one of the first questions on my mind was, how far is Josh Bell going to fall? Because he's unsignable. Who's going to take him?
Right.
Bam, first pick, Pirates taking him. And they did this last year with Stetson Alley. They gave Stetson Alley a $2 million bonus in the second round after he fell out of the first because of, he had a big price tag. He wasn't considered unsignable. You know, they tried it a couple years with Tanner Shepherds, who would have been a top 10 pick if he hadn't been hurt, and he didn't get healthy enough to sign. But that this is – you need to be bold and aggressive in the draft, especially if you're a smaller revenue team that hasn't enjoyed success. And my hat is off to the Pirates. I mean, it's amazing. And believe me, I heard this from a bunch of people. We were all talking about this last night, scouting directors, you know, draft observers. Frank Coonerly, you know, when he worked for MLB, his job was to tell teams not to spend on the draft and how you're just misguided, you shouldn't spend this money. First 3 years with the Pirates, they spend more on the draft than anybody. Last night, Frank Coonerly, who's now the team president of the Pirates, his team, on just their first two picks in the draft,
yep,
spent more on bonuses by more than $1 million than any team had ever spent on any draft. We're still gathering bonus information, so I don't know if the Pirates now hold the spending record. The Nationals, who set that record in each of the last 2 years, did their very best not to give that record up without a fight. And I don't have all the final tallies for all the later round picks, but the Pirates or the, you know, or the Nationals, I think, set a record for draft spending. We just don't know which one right now.
Yeah, just my eyeballing it this morning, Jim, was the Nationals were still going to pull, I think, a little bit ahead of the Pirates, but I could be wrong. I mean, the Pirates with $13 million and the first two players, we've already talked a lot about Josh Bell.
They got $1.2 million on their ninth rounder, too. So
I left that one out. That's a great point. Clay Holmes, that's a record for the round, correct?
I love my round records. And Clay Holmes, that record had lasted forever. The old ninth-round record was $750,000 by Jason Middlebrook. That was so long ago, John. It was my first stint at Baseball America in 1996 when that deal happened. So that record lasted 15 years until Clay Holmes, who's a projectable, big, strong Alabama high school right-hander, got $1.2 million from the Pirates as a ninth-round pick.
And Jason Middlebrook, hopefully Clay Holmes exceeds Jason Middlebrook's 77 2/3 big league innings. We'll just put it that way. You brought up 1996. That's the last time, Jim, that a player got a larger signing bonus in the draft than Gerrit Cole did, the first overall pick. And, of course, the players who got larger signing bonuses than Cole were free agents. Matt White, the seventh overall pick that year, and Travis Lee, who was a second overall pick that year. So Gerrit Cole gets the largest signing bonus in draft history. And that one was kind of nifty, too. He's a Boris Corporation client. And, Jim, I was impressed by the fact that, obviously, I think if you're a college pitcher, we've come to expect first-round elite college pitchers are going to get major league contracts. And if you're Gerrit Cole and you have Steven Strasburg type grades on your stuff with your fastball velocity and your breaking ball. He doesn't have Strasburg's command. I don't think he's quite as athletic as Strasburg, but he's explosive. You talked all summer like that was the aim. They were going to get $15 million or $15 million major league contract for Cole, but that seemed like the Boris Corp are going to try to use that as a benchmark. They didn't approach that. They didn't get the eight-figure contract of, say, like a Mark Pryor. But they got the biggest bonus in draft history. I thought that was pretty impressive as well, deal for just both for Pittsburgh, which doesn't have to spare a 40-man roster spot, and for the Cole camp and the Boris Corp. I think everybody kind of won on that one.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, it's funny because it's, we'd be interesting if we had a nice, like, point-counterpoint, and you had Gerrit Cole or you had Scott Boris, who advised Gerrit Cole. And you had one of the guys from CAA, which advised Danny Holton at number two, and they could argue over who got the better deal. I mean, Cole got the higher bonus at $8 million. Danny Holton got an $8.5 million guaranteed big league contract with the potential for more. I think he can get, the potential's for more in there if he earns, if he spends most of that time in the major leagues. I'm sure Scott would tell you, Garrett's deal doesn't include major league salaries, obviously. It would be an interesting point-counterpoint to see. I'm sure they both would pick their guy. I have no doubt about that. But maybe an interesting point-counterpoint to see how those deals were debated. But the bottom line is they're both great deals. Gerrit Cole gets a record bonus, and Danny Holston gets $8.5 million guaranteed, more guaranteed money up front, or not up front, but more guaranteed money than the number one pick in the draft in Gerrit Cole.
I was just about to say that's why I was going with Cole. I think Cole did well for himself, and they did well, but I think Holston's deal is a pretty sweet deal for Danny Holton, who was not expected to be the number two overall pick, but clearly the Mariners, they said we took him because we thought he was the second best player in this draft, and they paid him like it.
They did, and the thing is with him, I mean, it's an $8.5 million guaranteed, but if he spends, we'll throw out 2012, but let's say he spends, and he might make the big leagues next year, but if Danny Holton spends 13, 14, 15, 16 all in the big leagues, well, then he's going to make another I think one will be like a $10.3 million deal. So, again, I love Danny Holton. A little surprised he went number two in the draft because I don't think anybody saw that coming. The Mariners kept that close to the vest. And, I mean, I thought he'd get paid. Didn't necessarily think he'd get a higher guarantee than Gerrit Cole. Although, again, like I said, it's kind of apples and oranges because one's a big league contract, one's a straight bonus. And, you can argue the ins and outs of them. But tremendous deal for both those guys. And, again, I hammer this point home all the time, John. I'm sure there are listeners out there going, man, I can't believe the money these guys are getting. Teams want the talent, and they'll pay for the talent. Yep, yep. And just imagine what these guys would have gotten I'm not advocating having a draft, but what if this was like the old Wild West when there was no draft and these guys were free agents? Gerrit Cole and Danny Holson probably be signing for like $30 million major league contracts.
They would get what Dylan Bundy was asking for.
Or what Aroldis Chapman got.
Right.
You know, Aroldis Chapman's got a great arm, but it's not like he's exactly dominating major league baseball right now either.
Great point. That's an important point. I think is a very important point. It's the Baseball America podcast with John and Jim. We've got about 20 minutes. We're actually on a time limit today, so as opposed to the last podcast. Jim, we've talked about the Pirates a little bit, $13 million just on two players, so $14 million really yesterday, just counting Clay Holmes and those two guys at the top of the draft. The Nationals, we've also mentioned the Nationals spent a lot of money. We've touched a little bit on Matt Perk. Let's talk a little bit more about Matt Perk, Anthony Rendon, Brian Goodwin. I think we all knew, you and I talked for the last 3 years, Alex Meyer's going to get $2 million when he comes out as a junior. That's what he got. We should have laid some money down on that in Vegas. I think Brian Goodwin and Matt Perk are two of the other bigger surprises of the whole night. Brian Goodwin getting $3 million out of the Nationals as the first pick of the supplemental first round, and then Perk in the third round getting basically a Trevor Bauer-type contract. I guess Perk was the bigger surprise. I mean, what was the game plan for Matt Perk and the Nationals all summer? I mean, he never pitched this summer, correct? I mean, how could the Nationals make that? What is the basis for that contract? Their evaluation of Matt Perk in 2009 and maybe 2010?
Yeah, you know, what happened on that, it was interesting because when they drafted Matt Perk, you know, and for our listeners, I'm sure a lot of them know, but Matt Perk came into the year ranked as the third best prospect in the draft by Baseball America behind Anthony Rendon and Gerrit Cole. And it's amazing the Nationals got two of those guys with the 6 to 96 picks in the draft. Anyway, you know, freshman of the year last year, first round pick out of high school, agreed to $6 million with the Rangers, and MLB killed the deal because they controlled the team's finances. Came out this year, had shoulder issues, had some back issues, had some blister issues. Never really built up his arm strength in the offseason because he hadn't pitched in the summer fall. He went out there and competed, actually lowered his ERA by almost two runs in a lot fewer innings. But was never the guy that people had seen the previous 2 years. When the Nationals took a flyer on him, when they took him in the third round of the draft, I think the perception was, my perception was even up till a couple days ago, really, no way Matt Perk's going to sign for much less than the $6 million he was guaranteed, you know, he was going to get from the Rangers. And when the Nationals took him, John, Mike Rizzo was quoted as saying, we're going to evaluate him in the Cape Cod League. Well, rather than wind up pitching in the Cape Cod League, Perk and his advisors at Select Sports decided he'd be better off, you know, basically just doing a lot of, I don't know if it'd be rehab work, but more like strengthening work, you know, just trying to get back and get back to where he was rather than trying to do it in game situation, just with a lot of workouts at his home in the Houston area. I do know he threw a lot of bullpen, you know, did a lot of bullpen workouts. Nationals saw a lot of those. I think from what I've been told, very impressed with how hard he was. I mean, nobody's ever questioned. I mean, there may be people who don't like Matt Perk's delivery because it's a low three-quarters angle, and some people don't like, you know, think it's a slingy delivery, and that's part of the reason for the shoulder issues.
Right.
But nobody's ever questioned that Matt Perk competes hard and Matt Perk works hard. And I think the Nationals, even though he wasn't pitching, say, in the Cape Cod League like Anthony Renato did on his comeback trail last year, I think they were just very impressed with how hard Matt was going after it, how good he looked in the bullpen. And I guess they obviously saw enough to think 2009, 2010, Matt Perk was going to be back, was back, and he winds up getting a $2.75 million bonus and a major league deal with a guaranteed value of $4.15 million. And again, if he gets to the big leagues fairly quick, he can make as much as $5.6 million. So, he didn't get the $6 million he turned down out of high school, but he can get almost all of that six, or I shouldn't say turned down, that was taken away from him out of high school by MLB, but he can get almost $6 million if he's in the big leagues for the majority of his contract. And, that's one, like I said with Josh Bell, I didn't think there was any chance it was going to happen because I just didn't think he'd settle. I did not think the Nationals could pay him a number high enough, based on what he'd been doing this summer to get him to sign. But they came up with a creative way to get it done. It's funny, though, because you and I, you're reporting stuff during deadline day. You and I are talking all during the day. And, we're exchanging, the stuff we can't report. Like, hey, I'm hearing this rumor, but I'm not just going to throw a wild rumor out there. There were reports yesterday, John, when I was first hearing more, Perk's going to sign, Perk might sign. Guys were telling me $1.5 million big league deal. And I was like, $1.5 million, there's zero chance. Yeah. But that was going out there. And then it was a $2.5 million big league deal. And I was thinking, that just seemed light. Well, I mean, he blew that away. He got $2 million more than the rumor mill was telling us yesterday.
Yeah.
Which is why we don't traffic heavily in rumors, because they don't usually turn out to be correct.
That's it in a nutshell, which is, it's so dangerous with Twitter, and it's so dangerous in today's media environment. It's not, and I mean, heck, I forget who the player was, but I know 11 o'clock last night or 10:45, I was like, let me tweet this. You were like, no, that's not confirmed. Don't do that yet.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I will say this. With this, especially with the way they bottlenecked, MLB tried to make everything happen at once, so it was kind of chaos, and people couldn't figure out what other people were doing. Twitter's like, I don't know how we would have covered this signing deadline without Twitter this year, John. There's no way we could have blogged, you know, each signing as it happened. But, you know, I mean, we were talking about this, you know, like well into the morning last night. You know, the deadline hits at 12 Eastern, and, you know, also, you know, starting about 11:58, my phone, my instant message, my email, it's like bing, 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 like deal after deal after deal people are telling me about. And I think I typed for 20 or 25 minutes straight, took no break. You know, other than that, I answered a couple phone calls too, and all I was doing was like typing in deal, typing in deal, typing in deal.
That's
it. But like I said, I mean, Twitter, I mean, this could be a whole nother podcast, but Twitter, it was like a godsend. It's the best way to give out these like burst after burst after burst of news, and it was like 20 minutes of news nonstop, and thank God for Twitter. So
it was frenetic last night. Yeah, that is for sure. It was frenetic. It's the Baseball America podcast with John and Jim. Let's touch on a couple other clubs. We talked about the Nationals, Jim. What other clubs impressed you as far as sealing up the deal on the deadline last night and making an iffy, not an iffy, but like a team like the Brewers, for example, and the Diamondbacks, teams that had multiple first-round picks, get all theirs done. I guess it didn't seem like there was any team that really would say they had a disappointing night. A few players got away. Let me try to phrase the question in a more specific way. Were there some players who didn't sign who you really thought would sign besides a Beedy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like even with Beedy, I mean, like we said, the ingredients were there. And I do agree with your point. You know, I did not, when all was said and done, look at this and go, oh, there's the team that lost out. Because Toronto didn't sign Beedy, but they're as aggressive as anybody in the draft. They had extra picks. They got plenty of talent. You know, the next guy didn't sign was Brett Austin, high school catcher, who the Padres didn't sign the sandwich round. But the Padres still got Joe Ross done in the first round. They still got Austin Hedges, who a lot of people thought was as unsignable as any of the top prospects in the draft, you know, all spring. They got him done in the second round, plays the same position as Brett Austin. And they signed Michael Kelly in the sandwich round, another pitcher. So I don't think, you know, sure, they probably would have loved to have Brett Austin, but they get the pick back, and they got plenty of talent. You know, in the second round, the Yankees didn't sign a guy. Sam Stafford, who from all reports seems like he didn't pass a physical, but I think we felt like Sam Stafford was overdrafted in the second round. We didn't have him rated nearly that highly. The Yankees spent plenty of money elsewhere. You know, Seattle Mariners didn't get Kevin Crone done in the third round, but they got Holdson like we talked about. They got Brad Miller. They went and got Germany's first draft pick in the ninth round. Kevin Coho signed for $650. So they made up for it other ways. You know, I really don't think there's a team. You know, the Rockies didn't sign Peter O'Brien in the third round, and I'm sure they would have liked to sign him, but, you know, I mean, he went where he should have gone in the draft. They didn't work it out. They signed other players. You know, so be it. I don't think there's any team that's sitting here this morning going, oh, man, you know, we blew our draft. We didn't get the job done. I know the Marlins really wanted to go get Connor Barron in the third round.
Right.
They offered him $1 million, and he turned it down. If you're a team and you offer a third-round pick $1 million and he turns it down, you know, and you respect the decision, but I don't think the Marlins have never paid that kind of money to a pick that late in the draft. I don't think the Marlins should feel bad this morning. They did everything they could to try to get Connor Barron signed.
I was really shocked that Connor Barron turned him down $1 million to go to Southern Mississippi. I think Southern Miss had a big night. Let's take some of the Twitter questions that we had at John Manuel BA and at Jim Callis BA, and we'll wrap up the podcast. Joe LeCates, who visited the home office here this week, steady podcast listener and fan, not holding us.
You should have had him as a podcast guest, John.
I probably should, actually, but he said, I'm not holding you guys to it, but where does the national system rank after this haul? And I would say, Jim, you know, Mike Rizzo's quote to the Washington Post that I saw was, we're the talk of the industry right now. And I would say, you know, That's hilarious, A. B, I still think you have to say with Bryce Harper, Anthony Rendon, Matt Perk, Brian Goodwin, Alex Meyer, Matt Perk at the top
AJ
five.
AJ Cole, throw AJ Cole in there too. For
absolutely.
$2 million
AJ
last
Cole,
year.
Sammy Solis. I know they like the Robbie Ray kid from last year too. That's a top
Brad
five.
Peacock merged.
It's a top five farm system. I'm not going to say that. To me, the Blue Jays and Rays are still the top two farm systems off the top of my head. But the Nationals are right in there. When you talk about impact talent, if I had a little more faith in Alex Meyer, maybe a little bit more faith in Brian Goodwin, who I like, and a little more faith in Matt Perk's health, that would be maybe my number one farm system. But they're in the top five for me right now.
Yeah, I don't think I quite put them number one. And I always beg off these type of questions midseason because it's so hard to answer until you stack them up. Definitely top 10 organization. Very well could be top five. Again, it's hard to know how I remember last year we were talking about the Reds, and I like their system, but I didn't think it was, an elite. I didn't think it was like, one of baseball's best systems. And then we come around and we're lining all the organizations up. We're doing the prospect handbook, and I'm like, I really like the Reds. John, when we were talking about I should have listened to John because I really like the Reds farm system a lot more than I realized.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think they're somewhere in that 5 to 10 range probably for me.
Let's see. We've also got assuming hard slotting is a pipe dream. Other options in next year's CBA agreement to ease deadline craziness? Asks Whoa Doctor.
Well, I do think the hard slotting is not going to happen. What MLB would have to give up to get it, if they could, I think would be too much. The union doesn't want it. It would just create more problems. I think we're not looking at a lot of remedies. Short answer, the best thing MLB could do to make the draft run smoother is to leave it alone. The more they try to do things, the worse they make it. I think we'll get an earlier signing deadline. I think that'll be fairly easily negotiable. July 15th, July 1st, somewhere in there. Other than that, I don't know if there's a whole lot of remedies that are going to come out of the CBA. You may have trading draft picks. You may not. But that's going to create as many problems as it solves. There are going to be times where it'll be great for a team to trade draft pick. There'll be time where an agent's leveraging a team to make them trade the draft pick.
I agree. I'm against trading draft picks, Jim. And the reason why is other leagues trade draft picks because they don't have prospects. Baseball doesn't have to have trading of draft picks just because other leagues have it. They have minor leaguers. That's what they use. I don't understand why there's that disconnect, and I don't see just what you said. Trading of draft picks will create just as many problems as it might solve. So
it would create more interest, but it's not going to solve anything. I think the only other thing
how it creates any more interest in the draft.
There's not as much interest in the baseball draft as say the football draft. I do think
there's not interest in the football draft because of trading.
No, not because of trades. I'm just saying I think it would be interesting, maybe because I covered the draft and you covered the draft, if the Yankees traded, Phil Hughes to get the number five pick in this year's draft or something.
To me, the fact that there is not trading of draft picks and that the prospects are what gets traded instead, that's what creates interest in prospects. There'd be no interest or much less interest, I think, in the minor leagues and in prospects if they were trading of draft picks. But that's a whole other podcast. But I'm against – I think the knee-jerk reaction – of people to say, oh, we should trade draft picks. Why don't they? The other sports do it. They don't even think of that. The other sports don't have minor leagues. It's a big difference.
Right.
If in the NFL, if they could trade the rights to some sophomore in the SEC for an NFL-level player, they'd do it in a heartbeat.
No, you're right. And I was going to say one other thing, just getting back to the CBA question. The other thing that might change, I don't think it will have a great effect on how guys sign or anything. But one thing that might happen, I think we may see a change in the free agent compensation rules.
That would
result in perhaps fewer free agent picks, which I think would be good. Fewer compensation picks, which would be good. If you have a situation like this year, I mean, granted, they took Josh Bell and it worked out. But the Pirates, worst team in baseball, they get the number one pick. They don't have any rated free agents they lose. In a lot of cases, the teams don't feel like they can offer arbitration even if they do have free agents that are going to get compensation. And so they don't get the picks. So the Pirates pick one. And they don't pick again until 61 because there's 27 compensation picks in this year's draft, 27 supplemental first-round picks. So I think that may get reduced, but I don't think we're going to see major changes. I think we'll see an earlier signing deadline, which I think the money we'll spend will still be the same. It just will be a month earlier, and you'll see more guys get out and play, and you may see fewer compensation picks. But I don't think there's no quote-unquote cure for the draft, although, again, I don't think the draft necessarily needs to be cured. I think the teams, you know, the teams control the, you know, the players are limited to negotiating with one team. So these bonuses are already a lot less than they would be if these guys were on the open market. MLB needs to, in my opinion, be happy with, you know, they have done some things that have stemmed the growth of bonuses and reined them in some areas. And instead of being happy with what they've done, it's they get upset that they can't control every bonus. Well, you're not going to stop the Pirates from paying Gerrit Cole $8 million or the Mariners from paying Danny Holson $8.5 million or the Diamondbacks for giving Trevor Bauer $4.4 million and a guaranteed deal and Archie Bradley $5 million because teams want talent and they're going to do that. You should be happy you've controlled what you can control and be done with it, although I don't think – the commissioner's office shares my view on that.
I wish they would, but I completely agree with you. Wrapping up the podcast, we've got a couple Padres questions. Rick Wolfson and Woe Doctor both asking about the Padres. One asking, what was the Padres' final offer to Brett Austin? And another asking about thoughts on the Padres' draft in general. Will any of their draft picks make the top 100? I'll tell you, I think it's amazing, Jim, that Corey Spangenberg was the first rounder to sign, got a $1.8 million. He's already in low A. And Brian Goodwin, who, you know, the consensus in Florida in the junior colleges was, you know, Goodwin's a really good prospect and he's got upside, but people liked Spangenberg better. Goodwin gets $1.2 million more dollars than Spangenberg. I think Spangenberg's in the top 100. Who else on that Padres list might crack the top 100? And what'd you think of their draft performance overall?
I like their draft. I don't know if they necessarily have another top 100 guy besides Spangenberg. You know, again, with Brian Goodwin, and touch on him briefly, first three picks the Nationals spent, Anthony Rendon, Alex Meyer, Brian Goodwin all have the Boris Corporation. Everybody in baseball talks about how tight Mike Rizzo is with Scott Boris. You look at the Jason Worth contract, and I think there was just some one-stop shopping there that Brian Goodwin may have benefited from. Getting back to the Padres, I could see Spangenberg in the top 100. I don't even know if I think he's a lock top 100 guy, John.
I don't think he's a lock, but I think he is. He's an offensive second baseman with speed. I kind of like his profile.
He could. But anyway, but getting back to the Padres, on Brett Austin, I had heard going into the final weekend his initial asking price was $2 million. I believe they got the seven figures on them. I don't know how close they came. I like their draft. You know, again, it's you don't see necessarily a ton of guys from the draft make the top 100. I mean, this draft as a whole, I've been asked this question all year because we keep talking about how strong this draft is. The draft as a whole is probably going to have maybe 15 players, maybe 20 tops to make the top 100.
Right.
You know, guys come out of the draft. So, I mean, you aren't generally going to have a lot in a given draft make the top 100. But,
right.
I mean, just rattling through these guys from the top, you know, you touched on Spangenberg, you know, athletic, very good bat. Joe Ross, you know, ball comes out easy, 91-93. He's got good bloodlines with the brother in the big leagues. Michael Kelly, you know, real interesting, big-bodied, strong-arm pitcher. They got him in the sandwich round. Jace Peterson, one of the more athletic college players available. You know, shortstop / cornerback on McNeese State's football team. Austin Hedges in the second round. You know, it's amazing. Austin Hedges gets $3 million in the second round. He's like a footnote in all this spending discussion we've had.
I can't even believe that. I've whiffed on that. Have I not mentioned more that Austin Hedges got $3 million in the second round? He would have broken
Josh
the record.
Bell got five. Josh Bell got five, so Austin Hedges is, you know, he comparison, I guess, but best defensive catchers in the draft in a while. So I think, you know, they maybe only one top 100 guy, but I like what they did. I mean, and, you know, again, you're talking a small revenue team, needs talent. They went out and got a lot of talent.
I cannot believe that I just keep forgetting to mention Austin Hedges getting $3 million. So that $3 million bonus won't necessarily get him into the top 100. I agree with you. There's maybe one or two at best for the Padres guys to get in that top 100. That's not a bad thing. It's just very difficult, I think, in your first draft. You know, your first year out of the draft to go straight to onto that top 100 prospect list. And finally, Zach Mortimer just wants to say, I think you've already mentioned it, but Zach Mort at Zach Mort says, how great of a job do the Pirates front office do? Yeah, I think you mentioned it. I think that you have to give some significant kudos to Neil Huntington and those guys, their front office, for the boldness of the Josh Bell pick and then for getting that done.
Greg Smith, the scouting director, and those guys. Right. And you know what? I'll throw kudos to Frank Coonerly. I know probably scouting directors gnashing their teeth. You hear me say this, but I mean, He's putting the money into the draft like he should. And as we touched on, we don't have to go over Josh Bell again, but as we touched on with Josh Bell, I really don't think there was any shenanigans there on the Pirates' part. I think they took him hoping to sign him, and they got it done. I don't think they knew they were signing him when they picked him. I just think they looked at it like, this guy's far and away the best player on the board going into day two of the draft, and we're going to take him.
If anyone's going to have this guy, it's going to be us. And that's the way they thought. And I think 28 other teams, the Tigers are not in that mix because the Tigers didn't have a shot at him. But I think 28 other teams wish they had taken that flyer on Josh Bell as well at $5 million. Good stuff, Jim. I'm sure we'll talk more about this throughout the fall when we have other podcasts. But we'll let you go. Thank you again for all the hard work on the signing deadline. And it was a lot of fun. Now we're going to both go get some sleep.
Exactly. Good talking to you, John.
All right, Jim. For Jim Callis, I'm John Manuel. It's the Baseball America podcast. We'll see you next time. Until then, so long, everybody.